This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. On October 8th, Hurricane Matthew made landfall in South Carolina and dumped 8 to 12 inches of rain as it moved northeast across our area. The true impact wasn't realized until a couple of days later when local rivers started to rise.
We are certainly starting to reference Floyd here.
In the evacuation areas, we estimated somewhere between 10 to 15,000 people.
Lots of major roads and secondary roads will be flooded, obviously impassable. Homes flooded as well, too.
The Calpin Landing community, the West Craven Heights or Chips community, they're basically all still in the water.
The heavy rainfall caused the banks of the Cape Fear, Neuse, Trent, and Kashai rivers to swell to levels not witnessed since the turn of the century. Even as skies cleared, more than 1,400 swift water rescues took place as teams used helicopters and boats to save people from rooftops and vehicles. Record-breaking floodwaters inundated homes and businesses.
Greenville will be making a possible similar announcement on evacuations, hopefully within the coming hour.
At first, Greenville and downtown New Bern were expected to be hit hard with flooding, but as the forecast changed day by day, other, more rural areas in Beaufort, Lenoir, and Craven counties were most affected. Aside from 28 deaths in the state, Matthew displaced thousands and caused $4.8 billion in damages.
We're going to have to replace all the carpet in the store. We have racks that are destroyed. This is more devastation than I anticipated seeing when I came in.
As soon as floodwaters receded, Eastern North Carolinians welcomed the National Guard, Army Corps of Engineers, Baptist Men, and other nonprofits in cleaning out their homes and sifting through their ruined belongings. The Federal Emergency Management Agency, along with the Small Business Administration, set up disaster assistance centers throughout eastern North Carolina to help fill out low-interest loan paperwork and grants. Now, 6 months after Hurricane Matthew, Lenoir County Emergency Services Director Roger Dale reports efforts there have shifted to long-term recovery in the form of property acquisition and relocation projects.
We have submitted the information to the state. I think there were 230 properties on that list to either be bought out or elevated.
Property owners from all over the county in Kinston, LaGrange, Pink Hill, and Grifton have applied for buyouts. Dale says they expect to hear back any day now from state and federal entities on criteria that would make a home eligible for buyout. He says just because a resident's name is on the list doesn't necessarily mean the property will be bought.
I'm sure the next step will be as soon as we, kind of get word as to who would be eligible and who's not, that's when we go back to the ones who are eligible and, collect. And we'll have to collect more information, I'm sure. And that's how that process will start.
A property acquisition project implemented after Hurricane Fran in 1996 and Floyd 3 years later helped save money and lives during Hurricane Matthew. About 800 homes in Kinston were relocated out of the floodplain after those two powerhouse storms. Dale says there's a definite need for more buyouts, since Lenoir County still has about 800 homes and 170 businesses located within the Neuse River floodplain.
Where the residents are at now is the ones who we still have some displaced, who are not in their homes. And, some of them are waiting to see if they're going to be bought out, although I do not encourage them to do that. If you've got money to fix your home, you need to go back in and start trying, start fixing it, because you might not be one that's bought out.
Most Lenoir County residents impacted by Matthew have since returned to their homes or moved. Dale estimates the number of people living in transitional shelters like hotels and mobile homes to be in the single digits.
Our businesses, for the most part, are back open. There still might be one or two that, went in and did extensive remodeling, or just in some cases, or in one case, just totally built a new building. And I don't think it's open yet, but, we're slowly getting there. We're slowly getting back.
The cleanup and recovery process continues in neighboring Craven County, too. Director of Emergency Services Stanley Kite says the majority of flooding from Hurricane Matthew occurred along River Road near Weyerhaeuser.
We had probably a dozen or so that were severely damaged from the flooding. And then we had another 15 to 20 that had what we would consider moderate damage from the flooding.
Since the storm, most of the affected Craven County residents have rebuilt and have returned to their homes, although Kite says 6 to 8 people are still displaced and currently living in transitional housing.
We have now gone for a substantial amount of time where I think good progress is being made. Most of the debris is gone. We're still having some rehabilitation of some of the homes going on that were more severely damaged than others. We are now, you know, have a disaster recovery coalition group of volunteers that are out there working day to day on the individualized special needs. But I think for the most part, our recovery in our area has been significantly better or improved from what some were experiencing in other areas due to the low numbers.
Moving forward, Kite says non-governmental organizations like the American Red Cross, Salvation Army, and Religious Community Services will continue to work with residents until they get back on their feet. Craven County is currently identifying applicants for a mitigation program which would buy out property or raise houses in flood-prone areas.
There is also a resiliency development plan going on so far as trying to come up with conceptual ideas or means or ways to minimize or reduce this impact from occurring in the future. So there's several projects ongoing. The county planning department is kind of working hand in hand with those applicants who may be interested in the property acquisition or those that might be interested in elevation.
The mitigation program will likely be a topic of discussion at the final Hurricane Matthew Resilient Redevelopment Plan public meeting in New Bern on Wednesday. The forum, hosted by Craven County Government and North Carolina Emergency Management, will collect feedback on strategies that will serve as a roadmap for community rebuilding and revitalization assistance in Craven County's recovery plan. In just 6 months' time, a great deal of progress has been made, but Lenoir County Emergency Services Director Roger Dale says it will take years for a full recovery.
People, the businesses open back up, your people start getting back into houses, build new houses, and everybody says, oh, that's all, you know, that, well, we recovered. Well, we have from that standpoint, but then you still have the economy you have to deal with because that's got to catch up at some point in time.
According to Governor Pat McCrory's request for federal assistance for Hurricane Matthew recovery back in November, initial estimates show the economic damage of disruption to businesses is likely to exceed $2 billion. With the official start to the 2017 Atlantic hurricane season only a month and a half away, funds from state and local sources could help with recovery. $198 million is coming to North Carolina from federal flood relief. Governor Roy Cooper has asked Congress for an additional $1 billion, and a separate request for additional aid was sent to the General Assembly. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. Spring means strawberry season is upon us. It should be a solid season for North Carolina strawberries. Some farmers are even getting an early start. Chris Thomas has this.
The weather in eastern North Carolina is notoriously fickle, something farmers like Steve McLawhorn are acutely aware of. He's co-owner of Strawberries on 903 in Winterville and recalls what excessive rain did to his crop last year on his three-acre farm.
Last year we had an excellent crop, and Mother's Day week is probably a fourth of our season, and we had 7 days straight of rain. So when you have that much rain, we had to just hire a huge force of people to go in and pull berries that were too ripe off the plant, because when you leave those berries on there, the plant kind of shuts down, and also that berry goes bad and anything touching them does.
5 months later, in the fall, strawberry planting season began just as Hurricane Matthew brought major flooding to the region. A mid-March freeze after a mild winter caused a scare. But despite a rough off-season, McLawhorn is feeling upbeat about this year's prospects. He says there's about $12,000 worth of strawberries yearly in each crop.
Our normal season, we start picking around the 15th to 20th of April, so we're 3 weeks earlier than we've ever been.
The early season also excites Rich White, who owns White Farms on US 17 between Vanceboro and New Bern.
We've got a lot of blooms forming right now, so I'm looking 30 days from now we'll have another flush of fruit.
White had a tough year last harvest since El Nino dumped mass amounts of water across the eastern United States throughout the growing season between October and March. Last fall, Hurricane Matthew hit, and the subsequent flooding did too.
Well, we had just planted our strawberries. They'd been in the ground probably, I think, about 7 days. And you know, the wind blew, you know, and so we had to go back and go through the field and reset our berries and all.
Though they're susceptible to the elements like any other crop, strawberries grow low to the ground and are easier to protect. Covering called plasticulture is used during the off-season. While some farmers may struggle, North Carolina Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services Representative Dexter Hill believes strawberry farmers are, for the most part, in the clear. He's based in Kinston and works with local farmers.
We had really warm weather in February, we're followed by extreme cold weather in March, but North Carolina growers are very well prepared to protect their crops in cold weather by using row covers and overhead irrigation, and they came through the cold snap pretty good.
In contrast, blueberry farmers, who also have a presence in eastern North Carolina, are facing a much bleaker prospect. Blueberries grow on high bushes instead of up from the ground like strawberries. When the cold snap came, Hill said there was precious little farmers could do to protect them.
And the wind, in combination with the freezing weather, freezing temperatures, created an environment where they were really having a hard time frost protecting over the top of the blueberry bushes. So some of the nozzles were freezing up, the wind was blowing the water around, and so they did suffer some damage.
Strawberries bring in more than $20 million to the state's economy, but strawberry farms are usually smaller operations than the state's bigger cash crops, like sweet potatoes or soybeans. Many strawberry farms have a U-pick component where patrons pick the crop at the source and pay for the haul, usually by the pound. Most of those strawberries stay in the communities where they are picked.
The majority of the North Carolina berries, and what sets them apart is and makes them unique, is the fact that they're direct market, so you're getting a strawberry. Even when you go into a retail outlet, if it's a North Carolina label, that means it was probably picked in the last 24 hours.
Rich White's farm runs exclusively on a U-pick model at $1.65 per pound. He says it cuts down on the biggest headache he had with commercial farming: labor and tight deadlines for commercial buyers.
Most of my deadlines for having the strawberries picked and delivered were 1 o'clock that afternoon. So we had to pick early in the morning, get them packaged, and get them delivered by 1 o'clock. My order would be 1,000 to 1,500 quarts.
Whether you purchase local strawberries from the store, farmer's market, or you pick them up yourself, now is the time to get them. Summer's coming, and that means the end of the harvest season. That's not to mention what may happen if summer comes in too hot, too quickly, especially when considering the plastic covers that usually protect the crop from the cold and rain.
Normally we can go through May, sometimes the 1st of June. The hindrance on the end of the season is it getting too hot. The berries just won't last in the field when it gets too hot on that plastic. Plastic speeds them up in the spring when it's cool, but it hurts you a little bit when it gets hotter.
About how hot is too hot for these kind of berries?
In the 90s for several days.
It's coming is inevitable, so you may want to get out there and pick some. I'm Chris Thomas.
A new report ranks the Neuse and Cape Fear rivers in the top 10 most endangered rivers in America. It's the third time the Neuse River has been on the list in the past two decades. Both river basins have endured two 500-year floods from hurricanes in less than 20 years, during which dozens of animal waste lagoons were flooded or breached, discharging millions of gallons of waste directly into the rivers. A report released this week by Washington, D.C.-based American Rivers calls on the North Carolina General Assembly to include funding in the Hurricane Matthew Recovery Bill under consideration to reinstate the floodplain buyout program, which would move existing swine and poultry feeding operations out of floodplains. Today I'm speaking with Peter Robb, the North Carolina Conservation Director for American Rivers. And Peter, each year since 1984, your organization has released their annual report, America's Most Endangered Rivers. What are the criteria for selecting these rivers?
The biggest criteria is that there is a threat that can be resolved in the next calendar year. That's really what we look for, and it's a competitive process across the country where rivers are nominated by community groups, and we select the top 10 applicants.
The headline for the report is America's Most Endangered Rivers. What exactly does that mean, endangered rivers?
It's not saying that there's a chronic problem. It is saying that there's a specific problem that's coming up this year that can be resolved.
And the number 7 spot is the Neuse and Cape Fear rivers. How did they end up on this year's list?
I think after the horrific flooding that we saw as part of Hurricane Matthew, we realized that there were some significant opportunities to help out some of the farmers that are trying to protect the resource by getting their waste lagoons and waste piles out of the floodplain. We just don't think that the North Carolina General Assembly was paying as much attention to it as was needed. And so we see this as an opportunity to help those farmers do the right thing to conserve the river and protect drinking water.
Okay, so during the flooding caused by Hurricane Matthew back in October, According to your report, 15 lagoons were overwhelmed, spilling waste into public waterways. How does that, the increased nutrient load, how does that impact the environment?
The biggest issue that we see with those, with that waste gets into the river system is algal blooms or algae growth. And that is an indication of high nitrogen phosphorus in the river. And those can cause fish kills and can also create treatment issues for your drinking water plants.
And those nutrients eventually work their way down the river system and into the Pamlico Sound and Cape Fear estuary, right?
That is correct. I think one of the biggest concerns is to the fishing industry and the recreational industry along the coast when you get those really amazing algal blooms and algal growth.
Are we seeing that now?
I don't think the conditions are quite right for algal bloom. I haven't been out on the rivers in the last couple of days. Usually you need to have warm temperatures and low flows. We are seeing some drought-like conditions across the state, but I don't believe that there are algal blooms out there right now. But wait until August when we don't have the rains and it's 98 degrees, and we'll probably start seeing some of that again.
How many animal waste lagoons are still located within the floodplains here in eastern North Carolina?
I think we are estimating that there are about 65 potentials that would be strong candidates for relocation outside of the floodplain.
That's one thing that the report recommends is reinstating the swine buyout program that went into effect following Hurricane Floyd in 1999, program relocating over 100 waste lagoons. Can you describe if the General Assembly were to consider another buyout, what do you think it would look like?
I think it should be very similar to the buyout program that was developed after Hurricane Floyd. Ideally, we would finish off. I think they had 138 producers submit. I think they were looking at 43 of those operations were able to be relocated, which, as you said, was about 100 lagoons. So we've got more producers wanting to do it than we had the funding for at that point in time. But I think one of the other key features right now is we've had some really great growth of our poultry operations in North Carolina. And those facilities also sometimes have their waste piles located right in the floodplain. And so expanding the buyout program to deal not only with swine facilities, but also our poultry facilities so that those farmers can properly manage their waste outside of the floodplain.
Earlier this week, the chief executive officer for the North Carolina Pork Council, Andy Curlis, said the industry would support in concept a voluntary buyout program. Now, moving forward, will you be working with the North Carolina Pork Council and legislators on this?
Yes, I think that this is a common sense solution that has broad support. Right now, it's really just trying to get the attention of the General Assembly to understand that this is something that's really important not only for the agricultural community, but also for the environmental areas down there. So I look forward to working with the General Assembly to find the money to invest in this as part of the Hurricane Matthew recovery bill.
Peter Robb is the North Carolina Conservation Director for American Rivers. Peter, thanks so much for speaking with me.
Absolutely, and thanks for covering this.
Sharing science with stories. That's the idea behind the Science Storytelling Show on Tuesday evening in Kinston. The event will feature a lineup of five scientists and community members sharing personal accounts of how science has impacted their lives. Today, Mac McKee speaks with the Director of Public Science for the College of Sciences at North Carolina State University, Dr. Holly Menninger.
Have you ever done a science storytelling show before, or is this a first?
This is a first for our group at NC State. We are partnering with experts in this area, a group called the Story Collider, who is dedicated to bringing true stories of science to life on stage. Historically, they've worked in larger cities, so they have regular shows in places like New York and Boston and Washington, D.C. But this is their first show in North Carolina and their first show in a more rural area.
Now, how was this idea first concocted?
Our group at NC State is comprised of scientists, educators, and science communicators. And as part of the North Carolina Science Festival, which is happening right now between April 7th and 22nd, we were looking for an opportunity to connect people to science in a new and interesting way. Typically, folks think about science outreach, they think about it happening at a museum or a science center or maybe even a university. We're trying to break the mold a little bit and bring science to to people and communities by going to a bar. That's one way to kind of get people where they may not be expecting science. And the second thing that we're doing that's pretty interesting, or I think is pretty interesting, is that we're going at it in a more entertainment kind of way. We think that stories are something that are part of the common human experience and are a really great way to help people connect with science and even scientists in meaningful and personal ways.
Now, of course, as you've mentioned, the evening is going to consist of these storytellers, and they're going to be sharing these true personal accounts of blazing new trails and exploring new territories in science. Can you give us a preview of some of the topics that are going to be covered this evening?
Sure. We're going to have a story from a woman who brought her family out of poverty by going back to school to study electronic engineering and who got a job as the only female electrician at a local power plant. We'll have a story from a psychologist who's going to talk about how he taught chimpanzees how to communicate with sign language. We have another story from an ecologist who is actually going to talk not about his science, but how prayer and science work together to help him cope with his wife's cancer diagnosis. We'll have a story from another scientist, from a biologist, who will talk about her struggle to reconcile her scientific career with motherhood. And our final story will be about trying a woman who tried to find the perfect non-desk job for herself and how she came to find that as a park ranger.
Now, how did you happen to find all of these various people, do all this different presenting?
We put out a broad call several months ago to recruit storytellers. We were really interested in hearing stories from scientists themselves, and so we reached out to all of the universities in North Carolina. But then we also wanted to hear from community members, and so we worked through our networks and our channels and social media to try to recruit people. And from there, we had nearly 40 people submit stories, pitch stories, and then we worked with the Story Collider team to find the best fit so that the evening will really have an arc and should be full of, I think, funny as well as heartbreaking and poignant stories.
Now, how did you decide on doing the presentation in Kinston?
We thought it would be really exciting to take science outside of the science-saturated research triangle and go to a community that may not have as ready access to both science and scientists. We're also looking for a community that might be receptive to sort of a wacky idea of going into a bar and having scientists storytellers. We were impressed with sort of the growing energy in Kinston and the cultural vibrancy there.
Dr. Holly Menninger is the Director of Public Science at NC State University. Dr. Menninger, thank you so much for being our guest on the Downeast Journal.
Thank you for having me.
The Science Storytelling Show will be happening Tuesday, April 18th at 7 p.m. For more information, you can go to the ENC events calendar at publicradioeast.org.
This is Byron Muma, and here's what's up with the Carolina skies. Jupiter reaches opposition in April, which means right now the Earth is closest to Jupiter, the closest point it will be for the entire year. So right now, Jupiter is only about 413 million miles away. During April and May, it's a great time to get out there and look at Jupiter. At opposition, it means that just as the sun is setting in the west, Jupiter is rising in the east. About 9 o'clock at night, you can start observing. By 9:30 or 10 o'clock, it'll be really well positioned. There are a lot of interesting statistics about Jupiter. It is so huge. In terms of volume, it's about 1,300 times bigger than the Earth. In terms of its diameter, it's about 11 times the diameter of the Earth. Jupiter is our favorite target as planets go because it is so large, we can actually see a lot of detail. The first thing you note when you're looking at Jupiter is there are belts and zones, the stripes that you see across the planet. The dark stripes are the belts, the light colors are the zones. These are actually cloud bands that are moving, the winds are blowing in opposite directions, a couple hundred miles per hour. The next thing we look for on Jupiter is the Great Red Spot. This is a famous storm that's been on Jupiter for a couple hundred years at least. People started observing the Great Red Spot very carefully back in the 1870s. And based on these measurements, we know that it is shrinking. And it has shrunk just noticeably just in the last 30 years. Also on Jupiter you can occasionally see white spots. This is where there's material welling up from down deep in the atmosphere, and it comes up and it forms a white spot. Fun thing with looking at Jupiter is how rapidly things change. A day on Jupiter is only 10 hours long, which means an object that you're looking at on one side of the face of the planet in 4 hours' time, 4.5 hours' time, will move completely over to the other side of the planet. And remember, even with a small instrument, even with just binoculars, you can usually see the four Galilean satellites of Jupiter, that is, four brightest moons, Io, Callisto, Europa, and Ganymede. Jupiter has about 63 moons, but these four in particular are very easy to spot. Observing those moons traveling around Jupiter at night, you'll actually see them change position. You might see a moon that you're observing duck in behind the planet. Another one might be just emerging on the opposite side. Some nights you'll see two moons, some nights you'll see three moons, some nights you'll see four moons. But if you watch over a period of 2 hours' time, you'll really see how they change position. All great things about Jupiter. It makes it my favorite thing to look at among the planets.